Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A state house panel in Lansing has kicked off a series of hearings on Common Core, the set of education standards put together by the National Governors Association and being debated all across the country. On today's show, we speak with Michigan School Board President John Austin, a supporter of Common Core, and we speak with State Representative Tom McMillan, an opponent of the standards. And later in the hour, there are so many microbreweries in the state, it's actually getting hard to keep track of them all. But first, the latest word on new car sales in Europe is not anything bringing cheer at GM, Ford, and Chrysler headquarters. New car sales in Europe have just suffered their worst June in 17 years. And in the last 6 months, new car sales have dropped 7%. They're at their worst level in 20 years. Let's look at what's behind this protracted free fall in European car sales. Joining us from the BBC in London is reporter Russell Padmore. Welcome.
Oh, it's nice to be with you.
Now, which countries and which automakers took the biggest hit, Russell?
Well, we already know there have been a lot of problems across the European Union with the various economies. Austerity is the watchword in many nations. I suppose the alarming numbers are coming out of Germany now. This has been what many people would say to be the paymaster of the European Union. Mm-hmm. But we're now seeing sales slumping in Germany last month by nearly 5%.
Why was that?
Well, we're starting to see the effects, I suppose, of consumers reacting to the austerity. A lot of people unemployed, youth unemployment in particular, and the younger people might be those who are going to buy a new car, maybe with the help of dad and mum, but they're maybe going to enter that new car market. They have no prospect of a job in countries like Italy, Spain, Ireland even. Greece, of course, often in the news with protests in the streets of Athens about the austerity. We're seeing people worried about the future. And let's look at the bottom line. If you're a consumer and you're either not in work at the moment, no prospect of work, you're not going to spend money on a new car, or alternatively, if you are in a job at the moment but you're a bit worried about the future, you're maybe going to hang on. You might be driving that old clunker just a bit longer, fearing, yeah, I'll keep this car going. I can't afford a new one just in case I lose my job.
Now, the UK was the only major market to expand, wasn't it?
Yes, we've seen expansion in the UK, but I suppose I should be very cruel in talking about the British car industry in that it's not really British anymore. Major manufacturers here are the Japanese groups such as Toyota and Honda. It's interesting, actually, right across Europe that the industry has been talking about huge competition from Asia. Alarming numbers for the French manufacturer PSA or Peugeot Citroën, sales down 11% in June. You mentioned Chrysler, which is controlled by Fiat of Italy. Mm-hmm. Fiat sales plummeted 14% across the 27 EU member nations. And it's not just the European manufacturers suffering. General Motors sales down nearly 10% in Europe, and maybe quite worrying for GM, sales of the Chevrolet brand, which are not quite the same Chevys that you would have in the US, but Chevy sales down 23% in Europe. Maybe one bright spark, Ford, the Blue Oval, sales up 7%, but alongside that, Ford has been talking about losses in Europe this year of $2 billion.
So what are auto executives in Europe saying about all of this, Russell?
They're putting pressure on governments to say, look, consumers don't want to spend money because of the economic health of the nation that they're in. They want austerity finally over and done with. They want economies improved. I've been talking with Ivan Hodach. Now, he's the Secretary General of the European Automobile Manufacturers Association. Naturally, he expressed alarm about the state of the industry.
We have seen restructuring from Ford, from PSA. Other companies are thinking about it. We have today 30-35% overcapacity in Europe. We have companies, factories that run below 50% capacity. We will have to do something about it. There's no question that, we need to get over this hurdle and get the economy back growing and the confidence of the consumer restoring. But we probably will have to also strip a little bit more the industry.
So what's key for the industry is an upturn in the region's economy. That's still some way off. In the meanwhile, could governments do something to help the car manufacturers sell the vehicles, a change in the tax structure, for example?
Mm-hmm. The governments can help on the regulatory side. I think it's time to review all the different regulations that fall on the head of the industry. coming mainly from Brussels that made the cost of production extremely expensive in Europe. That's where the governments, and especially the European Union, can do something.
Now, you can see, Cindy, there that Ivan Hodac is referring to the role that governments have to play. There is, some consumers would say, too much tax on cars in Europe, and I suppose the manufacturers are also worried about the increasing cost as a lot of their workers, for example, are looking for higher wages. And the problem, too, so much overcapacity in the industry. They're producing too many cars here. I'll give you one example of that. Just last year, I was talking to a few insiders in the European automobile industry, and one of them said to me quite starkly, each nation needs to close one car factory, and that still might not solve the problem. And governments, of course, don't want to see the job losses.
And then, of course, it's just a more complicated procedure for automakers because of the union situation in Europe versus here with the UAW. So trying to tackle that problem of overcapacity is really more complicated, isn't it?
Yes, it's been a real challenge, particularly for General Motors, where it's been trying to do something with its Opel brand, particularly in Germany. Now, you can understand that unlike the US, where there's one country, and so if a car manufacturer wants to reach a deal with the trade unions, a lot of talks go on in Detroit, and OK, bad news might be coming down the track, but eventually it comes and the workers accept it in a deal with the big three in Detroit. The trouble is here in Europe, a European Union, 27 different nations. There are so many branches that the various trade unions have to talk to. The car manufacturers not quite sure exactly which country they should actually make any cuts or restructuring in. And they come under intense political pressure. For example, as I say, General Motors thinking about making restructuring at its Opel subsidiary. But then again, where does it do that? Does it cut the Vauxhall brand, which is part of GM in the UK? Or does it cut, as it's known across the rest of Europe, as Opel in places like Germany? And the German government saying, well, look, we're the one country which seemingly is still doing well. You should not be cutting jobs here.
It certainly seems like there is not much light at the end of the tunnel, even though the president of the European Central Bank did predict a subdued recovery for later this year, didn't he?
Yes, we've heard a lot of talk about recovery, and it would be fair to say some nations are finally turning the corner. Maybe the one bright spark for the troubled parts of the European Union in the Eurozone would be Ireland. We're now starting to see, after all the bailouts that the Irish went through, finally that country's beginning to turn the corner, but it's still a long way from being healthy again, the Irish economy. The real key thing is we need those bigger nations getting their economies back on track again, particularly troubled countries like Spain and Italy, where there's so much unemployment. It's all about how consumers feel. If you know you've got a job and you're going to have it in the future, you will spend on luxury items, maybe a brand new car. But in the meanwhile, people are still hanging on to that old clunker, unwilling to spend. And perhaps that's the wise thing to do for a consumer. Governments have a role to play. The industry, of course, can do something for itself too. The car manufacturers know they're producing too many cars. They're going to have to make cuts. And of course, that adds to the unemployment situation, a real challenge for all the stakeholders in the industry here.
Russell Padmore, BBC News, joining us from London. Thanks for speaking with us today, Russell.
Cindy, thank you. Good being with you.
So what do these European car sales numbers mean to folks at the Rensen in Detroit or the Glasshouse in Dearborn or the Tech Center in Auburn Hills? In other words, how are those poor sales in Europe affecting GM, Ford, and Chrysler? For that, we turn to auto analyst Michelle Krebs. She's with Edmunds.com. Welcome back to the program, Michelle.
Thank you for having me.
Well, here we are, gangbuster sales here at home. So the domestic sales are great. How much, though, does the trouble in Europe take some of that happy, shiny feeling away for the Detroit 3?
Well, it absolutely does. The first thing I think that is a concern is, will we catch what Europe has here? We thought that a couple of years ago. It wasn't contagious. I think that we're fairly confident that it won't affect sales here in North America. However, General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler are global automakers, and they all have operations in Europe, and none of them are doing particularly well. And so it affects the bottom line of the automakers. And then next week, we'll see earnings from Ford and GM, and that will be pretty clear.
Now, unemployment, with the unemployment so high in Europe and the government austerity programs have hit people hard, even in a psychic way, people are not feeling optimistic. Can the sales and marketing teams for the Detroit 3 overcome that?
No. They have had to restructure their operations Ford expects to be break even 2015. I think General Motors the same. But the overall economy kind of overshadows anything that they can do on a sales and marketing side. And right now, there's a lot of discounting going on there to just get people to buy at all.
What lessons do you think, if any, have the Detroit automakers learned from coping with the Great Recession here in the U.S. that they might be able to use with dealing with the recession in Europe?
Well, that's exactly what they're trying to do. If you look at what Ford has talked about, is they're trying to take the lessons they learned in restructuring and apply that to Europe. The big difference is you've got a bunch of different countries, all with too many car plants. Here we had the states, but it's not the same. No country wants to lose a car plant that employs a lot of people and that they have to figure out a way to support. So there's a lot of battling between the countries and the companies about closing plants. It was painful here, but we got it done, and that's exactly what has to happen in Europe, but it doesn't seem nobody's blinking.
So bottom line, Michelle Krebs, how closely do we in Michigan need to be watching what is happening across the pond in Europe?
Oh, I think we need to because we can't get complacent about here, and it's really important to keep this market going because there's – you know, while some people think it's bottomed out in Europe, people like Carlos Ghosn at Nissan Renault do not think it's bottomed out. And so there has to be a focus on keeping North America strong to sustain it through the problems with Europe.
Auto analyst Michelle Krebs is with Edmunds.com. Always a pleasure, Michelle. Thank you.
Thank you.
And up next, we find out why so many microbreweries are popping up around Michigan. And then a conversation about setting education standards. Should Michigan continue to implement Common Core standards? That's coming up in 20 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, there will be no X Games for the city of Detroit. ESPN announced today that Austin, Texas will host the Summer X Games for four straight years, starting in 2014. Detroiters had campaigned hard to get the games to the Motor City, competing with Austin, Chicago, and Charlotte, North Carolina. The Summer X Games are basically the unofficial Olympics of extreme action sports like skateboarding, rallycross, motocross, and BMX biking. So if you're upset about losing the X Games, perhaps you'll drown your sorrows about the X Games with beer, because here in Michigan, we love our suds. That's about the only conclusion you can make about the news that Michigan is now number 5 in the nation in the number of breweries, and we are 8th in craft beer output. Let's find out just how fast the craft beer industry is growing in Michigan as we say hello to Scott Graham, who's the executive director of the Michigan Brewers Guild. Hi, Scott.
Hi, and thanks for having us and talking about beer.
Let's talk beer. I'm wondering, Scott, how many breweries and microbreweries and brew pubs do we have going right now in our state?
Well, it's a little bit of a moving target. So I would say more than 140. We're well over 100. I can remember it wasn't that long ago. We were watching to see us hit triple digits, and we just seemed to be launching right on past that, as a lot of breweries have opened in the last 2 years, and there are quite a number of them in planning that I know about, and I'm sure a few that I don't.
And that has to be unusual, because did I see a statistic that said once upon a time, just as recently as 1991, there were only 3?
Yes, that is accurate. So I think we're probably now, we probably have the most breweries that we have had in the state since Prohibition.
And no one was counting those in any official way back then. So tell us this, Scott, how and why has craft brewing gone from virtually non-existent to the hot thing in Michigan?
Well, there was kind of a re-emergence of local beer that really started taking root maybe as early as the 70s or even late 60s, if you want to look at it, the rescue of Anchor Brewing Company in San Francisco. But what we're really seeing is just Michigan kind of following a national trend, but maybe lagging a little bit behind what you would see on the West Coast. And then we're kind of taking it, and it's getting a lot of great energy, and I'm sure Michigan is going to continue to trend well beyond the national average. But a number of things happened. As there was a huge void in flavorful local craft beer, and breweries started to pop up to satisfy that before anybody knew what was really going on. You know, that was one thing, and then there had to be legislative changes to allow for brew pubs, so it really got going slowly at first, but boy, in recent years, there's no holding the great beer state back.
In fact, I see that in May, Grand Rapids was named Beer City USA, and Kalamazoo was second, and Ann Arbor finished fourth.
Yeah, how about that?
Well, it got me wondering, with Michigan having this national reputation as a beer-loving state, what got that going? Is it our blue-collar heritage? Did that start things?
Well, I will tell you, we've seen trends in a lot of different products and really a shift in consumer preferences to things that are local and fresh and handmade and that you can connect to. And I think you can think of artisan breads or cheeses or coffee. You can look at wine. And beer's following right along those lines. And it seems to me that folks in Michigan are even more kind of local, loyal. They really respond to Michigan-based companies and Michigan-made products. So I think that both of those things are working.
I'm speaking with Scott Graham, who's the executive director of the Michigan Brewers Guild, talking about the just literal explosion in the number of craft breweries. We've got breweries and microbreweries and brew pubs, and from virtually nothing a few short years ago, over 140 of them now. And Scott, how do you keep your industry from becoming saturated? Could there be too many craft breweries in Michigan?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I can easily paint a picture that says there's a lot of room for continued growth in the industry. In 2012, by my number crunching, I would say that the amount of beer sold in Michigan that is brewed in Michigan is a little under 4% of all beer.
Okay.
I certainly expect to see it get to 10% and beyond, so that's 2.5 times or more volume. So the question is, well, where does that beer come from? And we have essentially two different types of breweries. We have three different license types in Michigan, and they kind of function as two different types. One is what I would call the brew pub, and that's essentially a restaurant with a brewery attached. So think of any local brew pub that does not distribute their beer. They're making it to serve the restaurant. You can get some to go, but it's really a local dining and gathering place and drinking establishment. So those are essentially restaurants. And I think you look at, you know, look at any community and say, well, how many restaurants can this community support? And if it's a well-run operation, it could be a brew pub.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are breweries and microbreweries that may have a restaurant attached, so that they may have this tap room, but really they're focused on growing and becoming bigger than the beer that they can sell there and distributing their beer through the distribution system, getting it out to other bars and restaurants and to grocery stores, party stores. And that volume is going to grow a lot as well. I think that that's maybe where most of the volume will grow.
Mm-hmm.
So we're seeing a lot of different beers on the shelf. I think the ones that are successful at getting there will sell more and more of their beer, and that'll be a good thing because it'll be ever fresher and, you know, ever livelier and better. But I would argue that there's a lot of room for these restaurant breweries, brew pubs, in many communities that don't have them yet.
And so on a hot day like this, Scott Graham, since you're the executive director of the Michigan Brewers Guild, you love your beer. What would you pull out of your refrigerator and open up for us if we were going to share a beer? What's your favorite?
My favorite beer is a fresh, well-made local beer that I'm drinking.
Whatever that may be.
So that's a good question. Whatever I pull out of the refrigerator, that's it.
Scott Graham, the executive director of the Michigan Brewers Guild, spoke to us from Gaylord today. Scott, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks and cheers.
Turning now to a dispute that's bubbling and brewing between environmentalists and business groups. The subject, whether to expand wetlands and waterway protections, long-delayed updates of the Federal Clean Water Act. The environmentalists are hoping these updates would give the EPA more muscle with which to protect our waters. But there are business groups that believe this would be costly and wouldn't pack much benefit. Well, joining the side of the environmentalists are 20 craft beer brewers, including 7 from Michigan. They've written a letter to President Obama arguing that pure, clean water is essential to making good beer. Among the Michigan brewers pushing for stricter water control measures is Jason Spalding, who owns Brewery Vivant in Grand Rapids. And Jason joins us now. Hi, Jason.
Hello.
Well, we have all seen President Obama is an unabashed beer lover, even to the point we know he bought a home brewing kit for the White House. So is that why you and the other Brewers for Clean Waters decided to write to the beer lover-in-chief?
You know, we all of us beer aficionados all stick together, so we're hoping Obama, being a fan of craft beer, might see things our way.
Did you get a response?
We haven't yet, but I know the NRDC, the Natural Resource Defense Council, is continually pushing for that, but I haven't seen a response yet. But maybe we'll sit down over beer with President Obama someday and talk about it.
What was it that was in the letter? What were you asking the president?
I guess we're asking to kind of put a little more muscle into the interpretation of how the Clean Water Act is written to see if we can get things back to where we are looking at a kind of a bigger picture of our entire water system. Being here in Michigan, water obviously is very important to us. And I think mostly where things kind of have fallen away or when they define navigable waters, you know, what exactly does that mean? And I know one of our big concerns is if you're not looking at your wetlands and things like that that feed into navigable waters, then you're not taking the big picture in mind, and you're allowing destruction of our natural waterways.
And what does that mean in terms of the everyday process of brewing the beer that you brew at Brewery Vivant?
Well, you know, traditionally, you know, when the first breweries came to the United States, they all located in places where there was great water. And, you know, here around the Great Lakes, a lot of breweries that are, you know, famous that people recall, Anheuser-Busch, you know, Miller, breweries like that, established their breweries in locations where they could get clean water, because mm-hmm. water is so important to brewing beer. And to us, you know, the biggest part of our beer is water. We always kind of kid around each other and say, you know, water is a dry subject to talk about with beer, but it is very, very important to us, and we're blessed by being here in the Great Lakes, and water is fantastic for brewing, and we just think it's worth protecting.
And to the business groups, the Michigan Chamber of Commerce being one of them, who say that increasing federal regulations, it's costly and it is unnecessary. What do you say?
I think there's always different viewpoints, but I think it's hard to argue against protecting a natural freshwater resource that we have here, regardless if you're talking, you know, people talk about jobs and development and things like that. I think we always have to take a balanced approach. But if we're not looking large scale and big picture, protecting our waters for generations to come, then I don't think we're doing ourselves any service.
We just spoke with the head of the Michigan Brewers Association, and we talked about the fact there are now over 140 breweries and brew pubs and microbreweries and in Michigan. And as one of those at Brewery Vivant in Grand Rapids, how important is Michigan's location in continuing this growth of the beer business?
I think for whatever reason, Michigan has just really taken off with craft beer. And we've built up, you know, kind of quietly a great reputation. If you talk about craft beer outside of Michigan, you know, we have a great, great reputation. I think we're still somewhat winning over our own people within our state, but it is growing, and it's getting more and more popular, more and more demand for it. And we just have a great tradition of brewing for, you know, many, many years. And I think that's kind of solidified our state and our area as being a great place for craft beer.
Jason Spalding, owner of Brewery Vivant in Grand Rapids. He joined with 19 other brewers in writing a letter to President Obama calling for tougher clean water rules by having the EPA expand wetlands and waterway protections. Jason, thanks for talking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you so much.
What can we learn from studying the buildings, the artifacts, the cultural landscapes of past civilizations? And how far back in the past do you go? Many centuries ago or just a few decades? Based on a special exhibition in its final few days at the Kelsey Museum of Archaeology at the University of Michigan, perhaps the answer is both. Photographer Susan Webb's exhibit, Red Rock and Rust Belt, shows the connections between two cities separated by thousands of miles and many centuries. The ancient site of Petra, established around 312 BC in what is now Jordan, and Detroit, the Detroit of the industrial 20th century. We're joined now by photographer Susan Webb, who's basically had a camera in her hand since her dad gave her a Kodak Brownie when she was just eight. So why did you choose Petra and then Detroit to compare and contrast in this exhibition?
Well, it was a fair bit of serendipity, actually. I was asked to do an exhibit in Australia. I wanted to go to Petra, hadn't been, went there, partially to do some other work. And when I shot it, loved it, absolutely loved it, and was moved by it on many levels. But it didn't seem like it was comfortable. It didn't sit properly. It was sort of like a three-legged chair.
Why was that? Why didn't it set right with you?
Many people have taken pictures of Petra, and it spoke to me, and, you know, I sort of specialize in archaeological photography. This was more, for me, something I wanted to speak about the people and about the past. And when I shot it, it just seemed like it was begging for a comparison, begging for something to say, this is what I'm about. You know, sometimes when you look at something, it's not quite clear unless you see something next to it.
And in this case, it was the city of Detroit.
It was.
You've been living here and working here in Southeast Michigan, but what was it like to go into Detroit with camera in hand, having been to Petra?
Well, it was interesting, Cindy, because I didn't want to actually shoot Detroit. It was suggested by a friend of mine who's a photographer from Australia. And I was feeling like, you know, I don't really know Detroit. I haven't been down there very much. I'm a little apprehensive about going to a place I don't know, which is so funny because I've traveled all over the world and been very comfortable in some really unusual places. So we went down, and it was not even an hour before I was so connected. I saw antiquity. I saw the people of the past. I saw Petra in Detroit. And I felt it on a very, very visceral level. And it was the beginning of many, many, many days that I went down to Detroit and took picture after picture after picture, and many times just sitting there and getting a feel for it, feel for the people. And now I'm a fan.
And what is that feel that you got?
It was a connection with the power of what people had been, where they'd come from. I mean, Petra was a magnificent city in its day, and Detroit was too, and I didn't realize what had gone on to create such a beautiful city. I didn't realize how magnificent Detroit had been and how magnificent I think it is still on many, many levels. The people that I met down there were the same as the people in Petra. They had a great love and a deep connection with their city. I was actually surprised by how strongly they felt. And I'm really surprised, again, seeing people come into my exhibit and look at these photographs, and they become emotional. And I felt emotional when I was shooting this. So when I see that in them, I'm very, very pleased about that connection.
As you have seen people come into the exhibit, and it's been extremely popular, and I just want to recap again that you've got until Sunday to be able to see this exhibit at the Kelsey Museum of Archaeology, Red Rock and Rust Belt. Was it an emotion of sadness? Because I looked through a book that you've given me with the images, and it did kind of strike a very poignant chord for me, thinking of what was and wondering what's ahead.
I know there's a sadness that may come, but I think that for me, it was done with the utmost of respect and the possibility that maybe people will see something about Detroit that is still there and can still continue and go on.
So there's hope in these images?
I believe there is. I really believe that there's hope in, you know, going to an ancient site and feeling the beauty and the magnificence of buildings. But I feel that going to Detroit, there is definitely hope. And I didn't know that it was there, and I felt it on so many levels, especially with the people.
There's stunning, stunning photographs of the exhibit Red Rock and Rust Belt, and it is in its final few days at the Kelsey Museum of Archaeology at the University of Michigan. And we are actually putting up a link to photographer Susan Webb's website. You can get a sampling in case you can't get to Ann Arbor before the exhibit closes on Sunday. You'll get an idea of some of these stunning photographs. Susan, thank you so much for coming into the studio and sharing with us.
Thanks so much for having me, Cindy.
And still to come, new Common Core educational standards are making headlines across the country. Many states have approved the new standards, but Michigan has not. We'll talk with a supporter and an opponent coming up next. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This week, a state House panel in Lansing kicked off a series of hearings on Common Core. You may have been hearing about the Common Core lately. They're a set of nationwide school standards put together by the National Governors Association, and they're being debated around the nation. State lawmakers recently passed a budget that bars the Michigan Department of Education from implementing the standards. Now, supporters, including Governor Snyder and State Superintendent Michael Flanagan, say Common Core is essential to making sure students in Michigan are ready for college, ready for careers. Opponents say the standards strip local control and they were developed without transparency. In a few minutes, we'll sit down with two guests, one for, one against Common Core. But first, we wanted to get a better understanding of just what these standards are. Joining us is Michelle Richard, Senior Consultant at Public Sector Consultants, specializing in education policy and research. Michelle, first off, how and why were these standards developed?
Yeah, so right now, well, 3 years ago, before the Common Core was established, every state had their own set of standards, Michigan included. So schools across Michigan have been implementing standards that were created at the state level for years. This is not uncommon practice. What makes it really tricky is how do you compare performance across states if they're not teaching exactly the same thing? And this was an effort to start allowing us to compare performance, but also an effort to say, college and career readiness is something that is essential for every child. And in a global economy, does a child in Michigan really need to have a dramatically different education than a child in New York or in Colorado? And so this effort was to really define what do kids need to know to be able to succeed at the next stage in their life.
Well, who put these standards together, Michelle?
So there were two groups that really led this effort, the National Governors Association, including Democrat and Republican governors, and then the Council of Chief State School Officers, which would be Superintendent Mike Flanagan and his colleagues. But it was not a federal effort. That's important to note that the federal government was not the ones leading this charge.
And how much input did the folks, the boots on the ground, the teachers in the schools, for instance, how much input did they have in putting together the standards?
So my understanding was that they had a real cross-section of folks who were engaged in that work. I know it's tricky when you start talking about a national effort. It's not the teacher next door that was likely to have been consulted. But when you look at big national teacher organizations like the National Education Association or the American Federation of Teachers, they certainly played a role and generally have been supportive of the effort.
Now, we need to, I guess, have you clarify and make this clear to everyone. Common Core doesn't actually set a curriculum for teachers to follow, but instead it's a set of skills and abilities that kids should have by the time they graduate?
That's exactly right. And that can be a really tricky concept if you don't come from a teaching background. I came from the classroom, so that to me is very clear. But when I talk about that to other folks in my office, I think about it like a Google Maps app, right? I set the destination and I say, I want to get here. And it gives me, you know, three or four options of how to get there. One is the fastest way. One is the most scenic way. One avoids freeways, right? You can go on and on. Common Core attempts to set destinations. What do we want every child to learn? But it leaves the how, that route part, up to students and families and teachers to be able to determine what makes the most sense in their classrooms to ensure that every child has the support that they need to be successful.
We've been speaking with Michelle Richard. Michelle's a senior consultant at Public Sector Consultants. Always a pleasure speaking with you, Michelle. Thank you.
Thank you.
So let's dig a little deeper into Common Core and turn now to hear from an opponent and a supporter of these standards. Joining us are Tom McMillan, Republican State Representative from Rochester Hills. Welcome and thank you for coming into the studio.
It's a pleasure being here.
And John Austin, President of the State Board of Education. Welcome back to Stateside, John.
Good to be with you.
I want to begin with some of the criticism of the Common Core standards. And one of the things that we hear a lot about is that they reduce state and local control of schools, and it's more big government overreaching. But Representative McMillan, I have to ask you, these standards were put into place by states' governors and not the federal government. What's your response?
Well, the NGA is not the state's governors. It's a private trade association. There are no minutes. There's no open meetings or FOIA. There's no, as a matter of fact, David Coleman, who was one of the main writers of the Common Core, he made it clear that he had to sell this to the governors. It was not something that was a collaborative effort that was actually done by the governors or by states. It was something done by some elite educators who think that they know what's best for everybody, including the children in each individual school in our state.
Do you believe the federal government was involved with that? Because that is something that we do hear from critics.
Well, we do know that the NGA was substantially funded by the federal government and by Gates Foundation. We also know that the assessments, which are very critical to Common Core, were funded by the federal government. Obama, in his State of the Union, made it clear that he is taking that as something that he's done. He has forced curriculum, and he even said curricula and standards throughout the nation.
John Austin, your comments?
Well, I think the Common Core is really just the next step or the current step in what has been a state-led evolution led by governors with the business community and education experts and education leadership, including in our case, the State Board of Education has the direct responsibility for designing what kind of standards we want all young people to learn. And it began 20 years ago when we realized it wasn't effective and helpful to young people to have wildly different education. And Governor Engler really was the governor at the time who embraced the standards movement and said, let's create that common learning platform, whether you're in Marquette or Munising or Monroe, that makes sure our young people are ready with the skills they need to succeed in entering college, entering community college, entering technical training, and being ready for the workplace. So it was with the help of education policy experts, with the help of the governors created an organization, Achieve, that was looking at policy expectations for exiting high school. And we as a state began the march in the 90s, in 2000, with common requirements for K-8 learning. And then we, in 2006, said, let's have high standards for exiting high school. We didn't have any high school exit requirements. And the Common Core is really just the next step that we've taken where we've improved on these standards to say, let's align our learning expectations for all young people, wherever they grow up.
Representative, give us a sense of what you see as the inherent danger and problem with having a set of standards like these.
Well, it's not the set of standards. It's who's writing them and who's going to determine the changes. And so the State Board has decided to turn that over to the National Governors Association. Any future changes in standards, Mike Flanagan, the state superintendent, made it clear to me in writing that if we don't like a standard that comes out, a change, we're still going to have to teach it. And if a teacher feels that it's going to be confusing to the child, she'll still have to teach that standard because it's going to be on the test. And he said, well, I guess maybe they don't have to teach it, but then they're going to be at a deficit where Michigan is going to be behind the other states when we have these high-stakes testing that we see with Smarter Balance.
And I respectfully disagree. We as a state, the state board, with the help of education experts and educators both here in our state and from around the country, the best practice of other states, we're the ones that develop these standards. First with our Michigan merit content expectations, and then we run processes. This is what we and the people elect the State Board of Education to do. We have long terms, 8 years. We do this on a bipartisan basis. We charge our superintendent and our staff to work with experts in education from our great Michigan education community, as well as the national organizations that are roping together what kind of practices are most effective to be college and career ready. And when we developed these standards and approved them, this latest round of Common Core, we did so with that kind of process, with that kind of public discussion. We reviewed the standards. We approved their direction because we think it's a natural, good step to tighten focus and make even more relevant to career and college-ready skills.
Well, I mean, you know, the experts, James Milgram from Stanford, I believe it is, and Sandra Stotsky were both on the validation committees and were one of the main educators that were actually on the validation committee for Common Core, and they said that these are very deficient. For example, the math, Milgram said that kids will leave high school 2 years behind being ready for college and being successful. And Stotsky said that, you know, a lot of the classical literature, I think in Massachusetts, now that they went to Common Core, studies show that about 60% of classical literature will not be taught anymore. You know, it's open for debate and it's cloaked in a lot of secrecy. We know that all the states didn't agree with everything, so there had to have been some give and take. What did we put in the standards? What did we not put in the standards? But none of that is accessible. None of that debate is accessible. Stotsky was very frustrated because there was no minutes. She gave her criticisms, but there was nothing on record to show who else was criticizing or what other concerns there were.
Why were there no minutes, and why is that not available?
When we, as a state and in the other states, developed our first set of state standards, we had fulsome discussion, expert involvement, lots of public discussion. So it's just not true that there hasn't been fulsome, thoughtful attention. I think it's telling that you'll always get good debate, but it's overwhelmingly supported, this Common Core, this set of learning expectations, by the business community, who business leaders from Michigan and other of their peer organizations, by the colleges and universities, who say this is very much what our young people need to master so they can matriculate successfully. Our education experts, teachers unions, education policymakers in Michigan and around the country overwhelmingly suggest that this is an excellent framework and an excellent set of foundational skills that we do want all young people to be delivered and have in their ability to successfully move ahead.
But is it transparent? Can people see the give and take and what went into that? Were their minutes kept?
The representative is alluding to some sort of national discussions, but I'm not sure where he's getting his information. I want to reiterate, we as a state and the states together entered into this movement to create a common foundation of skills.
Representative McMillan, why do you think so many other states, some 40 other states, have gone ahead with Common Core? Shouldn't this tell us something?
Well, you know, it should say that there was money available. There was $4 billion in Race to the Top money. So they were enticed. It was a time, if you remember, that all states were under a lot of money crunches. And so, you know, the Obama administration said, well, if you adopt Common Core, that will be counted in your favor in Race to the Top and trying to get that money. So there was a lot of states that took that. There's a large number, 10 to 15 at least, that are rethinking that and realizing that as it's actually being implemented, that we have indeed turned over our ability to change these standards to a national private entity, and that is something that's untenable and it's something that we shouldn't be giving up.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with John Austin, who's president of the State Board of Education, and with Republican State Representative Tom McMillan as we get into the Common Core. John, you've said you believe some of this opposition to the Common Core standards comes from the Tea Party. Explain that for us.
Well, I think it's unfortunate, Representative McMillan, and I gather others, what I believe is a relatively small number of elected officials and perhaps others are raising what I view as really red herring arguments that are wrong about Common Core. The two main arguments that they're making to try to prevent us from marching forward on this good evolution of having a good learning platform for all our young people are that this is somehow a federal curriculum or national takeover of education, and that it's somehow dumbing down or making worse our good state learning expectations for all our young people. And both of those are not true. As I've indicated, this is an effort where states, including Michigan, who's been a leader, are eager to put in place state-based performance expectations for what we want all young people to learn. It's not a national takeover, and it is an improvement and refining and even focusing of our already good rigorous standards that we had. It makes it teach more complex material. It makes it us teach fewer but deeper levels of content, so we don't have a million learning expectations. We have fewer that are the ones our young people need to actually master the content that will help them be prepared for their next steps.
And your response, Representative?
Well, I mean, it's unfortunate that you know, they try and malign people that are opposing Common Core. That this is a left and right. The foremost critic or educator on the left, Diane Ravitch, is very much against the Common Core. She has a blog that is daily talking about how it's a real problem. the assessments and the national tests are a real problem. And yeah, I mean, the nationalization of our schools is a very big problem, and we do oppose that. We do think that not being able to change standards that we don't like is a real problem. I can't imagine why anybody would want to turn over your ability to change standards to a private entity where you have no idea the debate or the open meet. There's no Open Meetings Act. There's no discussion about how those are going to be changed.
And again, we decided, the state of Michigan, the state board of education, whose job is to set the learning platform for all our young people, we chose to do this. It's not giving away power to somebody else. It's not any sort of takeover, because it's important for all our young people. And this is the main point. We can't go back to, you know, the 19th century when most people lived, grew up, and worked and died in their same little community village. And it was perfectly appropriate to teach whatever was needed in that community. Now we want all our young people to be able to succeed wherever they go, be able to go to University of Michigan or Grand Valley or Macomb Community College, or to go to Harvard. We want them to be able to go to work anywhere in Michigan. And I think it's a good thing when you see strong bipartisan support and even bipartisan disagreement on any topic. I mean, when we joined this standards movement, it was Bill Clinton visited, John Engler hosted him, and we announced in Michigan that we were joining this state-led movement of high state standards. And if Bill Clinton and John Engler can agree on something, it's a good sign.
But it's clear that if the standards change, we will have to adopt them. So then if the National Governors Association behind closed doors say that a standard is going to change, and they've already said they will change, you know, the State Board of Education will not be able to say, no, we reject that. Even though it may be bad for Michigan, we don't like it, it's confusing, we're still going to have to adopt it. I think we've turned over our authority, and that's the most troubling.
Now, looking at the fact that teachers are going to be going back to work at the beginning of September, they're going to be putting together lesson plans, but the state legislature might not even be voting on Common Core until the end of September. So what does this timing mean for teachers and for students, Representative?
Well, they'll be taking the MEEP test in the fall, so it's not the testing of the Smarter Balance high-stakes testing is scheduled for next year, late next year. So, they can continue to teach. And all that we're saying is that teachers should be able to be professionals and be able to say, look, this is a confusing, is it the lattice method, which is confusing to parents. And Cohen, the president of Achieve yesterday in the testimony, made it clear that these were not written with parents in mind, he said, which was very shocking. But because one of the Democrat legislators said, it's confusing. My kids bring this home and I can't help them. And if a teacher sees something confusing, if we don't stay with the Common Core, the teacher can say, look, this is confusing, kids. We're going to skip pages 18 to 22. They can be professionals, which we'd like to treat teachers as.
Teachers overwhelmingly in Michigan like the Common Core. We know our kids need a higher set of skills than we did as parents to succeed in this changing, more complex society. And my hope is that when we have some of these good discussions that the representative and others have encouraged, we will all, and the legislature itself, will be reassured that this is a good set of learning expectations. We make the decision, and we will make the decision to change if we need. As a state, it is our call. We decided to join, and we will have total ability to change, improve as we move ahead. It is ours to control, and we did this because we think it's helping our young people get that rich foundation that they need for success.
Yeah, but while teachers may say that they support it, the MEA, their magazine came out earlier this year that said 75% of them don't understand what they are and that they aren't teaching them currently and what exactly Common Core is. And I know that they're not excited about the high-stakes testing. The interest by many to tie them to their performance and to their pay, this is you teach to the test. So these standards are indeed going to inform the test, and the test will inform curriculum.
Well, I have to leave it there for today. But speaking of good conversations, we really appreciate both of you coming in to share your viewpoints on this. And I know there'll be more conversations as this unfolds throughout the year, very closely watched by parents and teachers. Thank you very, very much to both of you, Representative Tom McMillan, Republican from Rochester Hills, and the president of the State Board of Education, John Austin. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you very much.
Thank
you.
Thank you.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our director today is Mercedes Mejia. Stateside was engineered today by Tony Brown. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Austin Davis, Erica Decker, Emily Fox, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, Katie Theory, and April Van Buren. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.